ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
From the outside, the intense hyper-commercial culture of financial firms seems both fascinating and appalling. Think of the Wolf of Wall Street. What's it like from the inside, especially if you had already tried to step away from it to try to find a new kind of balance? Carrie Sun dived back into the belly of the beast as personal assistant to the billionaire founder of one of the hottest investment firms in New York, and she found herself slowly starting to disappear. Her new memoir is called Private Equity. Carrie Sun, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you so much for having me today.
It's a pleasure. And perhaps if you're listening to this discussion today, you've taken a step back from a demanding job too. How did it go? Did you discover a new way of being in the world and find work that suited you better? Or were you drawn back by bills? Our text line 0418 226 576. Carrie, before the job that you write about in the book, you were working in the field. You were a quantitative analyst, for a different major financial firm, and you were really good at it. Why did you decide to leave at that point?
I decided to leave my quantitative equities job at Fidelity Investments because, you know, after in college, I majored in math and finance. After that, I went directly to this large investment firm and I was working on the investment side of things. And, you know, in my 20s, I was starting to realize more of the life that I wanted to lead and also the person I wanted to be. And I came to discover that I just really loved stories and people a little more than I did love numbers and finance. And so I really wanted to give myself the time and space to go on this journey of self-discovery. And really, it was a kind of career self-discovery, because I was never, I did not have the self-knowledge when I started my job to know exactly what I wanted my future to look like. And I didn't come from money. So after college, being financially stable and independent was probably extremely top of mind. And so I sought this career. But after working there for four and a half years, I realized that I wanted to do something else. I wasn't sure exactly what. So I quit and went on this journey.
And as one reviewer puts it, you studied a lot and burned through your savings. But I mean, yes. Having come to that realization, Carrie, that this was what you wanted to be doing, what made you decide to go back into that world when a headhunter came along and said, hey, I got a gig for you?
Right. Well, you know, being a freelance writer, which I am now, and an author, it's incredibly difficult. And I needed a day job. I was burning through my savings. And I needed a job quickly. And I didn't want to kind of like dive full time, like, or just, I have to say, like, being on the investment side, I would feel more pressure. And obviously, you know, I ultimately wasn't able to make this day job work. Now, again, you know, I think that perhaps I was a little naive in thinking that I could make this day job work. But I will also say that I have several friends who are working as assistants to billionaires and writing novels in their free time, and they're able to make it work. And I wasn't one of those people that could make it work at this job.
For obvious reasons, when you read through the book, Private Equity, we're speaking with Carrie Sun, the author today. And I mean, Carrie, this company was billed as a fantastic place. I think the tagline was the kind of company that no one ever leaves, which makes me feel a little weirded out, I have to say. What was it, how was it pitched to you as such a great place to work?
It was pitched to me as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And that kind of line from The Devil Wears Prada about, you know, 1,000 girls would, like, kill for this or die for this or something, that was definitely the message I got, not only from my recruiter, but the people with whom I interviewed, and just the general vibe that this was someplace that everyone wanted to work, mostly because the pay was extremely high. The office was beautiful, and And on top of all that, it appears everyone there really cared about doing the right thing, being on the right side of ethics, morality, certainly the law, and wanting to, you know, be a good person. And that also really mattered, because in my first go around on Wall Street working at this investment firm right after college, you know, it was not a great culture to be a woman, and it was very, very tough. And there was a lot of sexual harassment, unfortunately. And so this kind of new culture, it was very attractive to me.
Yeah, it was interesting to read how your former employer seemed to walk the talk as well. He made you a believer again, you write, that, you know, that goodness and equity and justice were possible even in highly capitalist places.
Yes, he made me believe it. And I think it was actually because he really believed it as well. You know, and I think my book is a lot about unpacking kind of, we can have a certain beliefs and even have the best and good intentions of, you know, living out those beliefs in action. But then how do they really manifest themselves day to day? How do our values about who we want to be and what we want our working culture to be, how does it play out in everyday quotidian workplace situations? You know, and I think that really matters to me, which is why I chose to kind of write my memoir. I wanted to write certainly my story of self-discovery, but also a narrative critique of modern work and taking a look at how we work and why we work. And I was only able to do that when I got into the nitty-gritties of kind of these workplace situations where, you know, I really respect and admire my peers, and sometimes they were less than helpful to me in certain situations. And ultimately, at the end of the book, I arrive at sort of a understanding that they were probably going through some of the exact same issues of overload and overwork and burnout as I was going through as well.
Well, give us a sense of the amount and type of work that you were expected to do every day. I mean, I was struck by the 96 bullet points of responsibilities that you received on starting.
Yes. So though those bullet points, you know, every bullet point could be, you know, minutes of work to years of work. And the bullet points were things like no unanswered phones. So I was responsible for not only my line, but also my boss's line. And the phone rang so often. Often I would have multiple people on hold at the same time while someone else walked by in person, was like mouthing some emergency to me, and I had to take care of that. So that was just the level of overload and the volume, the intense volume of work. And I was really, my job, as I understood it then and now, was really pitched to me as an extension of him. I was to be an extension. He even said these words, an extension of his mind and eyes and ears. And I was just to be everything. I was to be his liaison to the outside world and manage information flow coming in and out of his office. And so it was an extremely stressful job. And I just ultimately think while any single one of those demands like seems okay and doable, but in aggregate, the total number of them and the amount of them, and then the way they, the kind of demands of my work, it, you know, framed as needing to go above and beyond always, going the extra mile. I mean, I just can't go the extra mile on every single task, you know, and I just ultimately think that the demands themselves ended up being impossible, and they were asking me to be superhuman.
Yeah, that's certainly what the effect is of reading your accounts of what you were expected to do. I love the telling anecdote from very early on in your time there when a late night email came in. Tell us about the email of your employer's kids.
Yeah. Yes, so this is my first day on the job. We had a company event that was a family day, and it was in the evening, and all the employees brought, their spouse and the people who had kids also brought their kids. And my boss's kids were there. And then after work, I was already home. It was something like 8 or 9 p.m. I got an email from him, and it was, I wasn't the only person. There was someone else copied on it. So I was like, okay, this is just a friendly personal email. It was after hours. It didn't have a question. It was just a photo of him and his kids. And my initial reaction was, oh, this is so cute. But I'm going to respond tomorrow, And especially because during my interview process, my boss had told me that he receives 7,000 emails in his inbox a day, and he needed my help to sort and triage the, emergency level of those emails and kind of get it under control. So my thought to myself was, I'm not going to burden him and clog up his inbox by sending one, in my eyes, like kind of like throwaway email. Well, I get into work the next day, and the first thing that happens is he calls me into his office, and he asks me, did you get my email last night? And I go, yes, I did. And I made some like cute face about, his kids who were so, so cute and so adorable. And I wanted to express that. And he immediately says that he expects me to respond to all of his emails instantly when I see them, with just a note that says, got it. Because he wants to know that I got his email. And so that kind of just set the tone immediately about the expectations for this job, which were certainly high, but there was also a time element that everything, including emails after hours on a personal topic, they were also urgent. And I had to respond to them as soon as I saw them, And so usually it was instantly within the minute.
Yeah, it's a horrific situation to imagine yourself in with all those competing expectations. I could feel my stress levels rising, Carrie Sun, as I was reading through this book, Private Equity. I was so struck too by a couple of moments that I'd like to discuss with you. There was one on the treadmill, and it's such a kind of the literal treadmill and the metaphorical treadmill come together. Tell us about that.
Yes. So happy you mentioned that moment, because sometimes I think to myself, it's almost too perfect and literal a metaphor that, I was on the treadmill at work, jogging on the treadmill of work and at work in this, as you said earlier, this beautiful gym that overlooked Central Park. And I was, watching the sunset over Central Park. And I... in the middle of an hour-long run, my phone dings. Now, it's very related to my first day of work, when my boss kind of gave me feedback that I need to respond to everything he, emails and texts me instantly. Well, it had been maybe 6 months into work, and I really needed this hour of exercise time to myself. And I set myself this one goal of 1 hour, one uninterrupted hour on the treadmill, because working out and running is a way for me to center myself and for me to feel connected with myself and feel good, not just about myself, but also be able to work again and feel well about it. And so And I'm in the middle of this run, 30 minutes in, and I get a ding, and it's from my boss. And I have this back and forth with myself saying, I shouldn't respond, but I have to respond, but it can wait 30 minutes. And it was not a time-sensitive email. Well, ultimately, I decided to continue running and answer his email. And immediately after I picked up the phone and tried to type a reply, I didn't even make a single word. I don't know. I wiped out. I fell, and I completely hurt myself. I completely skinned my knees. My knees have scars to this day on both sides from that fall. And my thoughts immediately after falling on the treadmill and hurting not just my skin, but I was in pain everywhere, joints, hands, head. Like, how am I going to do work? This is going to affect my work, and my boss is going to be so upset at me. And that was my first response, and it was not great. But, you know, I thought I would have learned a lesson then. It was too early in my journey of self-discovery. As soon as my knees healed, I got right back on the treadmill.
Literally and metaphorically. This book is rich in metaphor, I find. And yes. I love that, you know, you went to a therapist at one point and detailed all the things you were doing and also all your physical symptoms. And they said, nothing's wrong with you. Your job is killing you. What was it like to hear someone else say that?
It was so difficult. You know, when my boss, well, you know, before that, before that moment with my therapist, my boss had been telling me this is in the book, you know, he had been just making me feel like my burnout is entirely my fault and somehow that I wasn't tough enough. And he said that, you know, he had been burnt out for 10 plus years. And if he can do it, then I can too. Now, of course, some of that is sort of motivating because, you know, he's a really successful person. And I, at that time and still now, I admire, you know, definitely parts of him and what he's built in the firm and broadly in society. And so I wanted to be able to be the person who could tough it out and make it. But by the time I got to see this therapist, and I have to say, it's a therapist that my boss actually told me to get because I asked him for help. And he said, I think you should get help yourself to learn how to deal with stress better. And as soon as I saw this therapist, she was like, the problem isn't you. The problem is your job. It's killing you. And I, you know, it was honestly a shock, but I have to give myself a little credit. After that, I pretty much quickly saw through this like veil and this false reality that I had been building, and kind of the scales fell from my eyes. And I think it was because at that time I finally felt ready to receive those realizations on some level. I actually knew within me, and they were just coming to the surface. And what's so sad is just this week, I was reading about the working conditions on Wall Street. I think this is the sad news that's out this week. An investment banker died recently from overwork on Wall Street after he completed a deal. And so my therapist's words, if your job is killing you, sadly, I think it proves to be the case.
Yeah, the literal and the metaphorical meeting again. Carrie Sun, you write really beautifully about how some of your earlier experiences had formed you into what you call the perfect handmaiden for financial capitalism and some of the factors that made it really difficult to leave. I'm wondering too how much your family's story of migration and hard work and that drive to success played into your thinking about taking or leaving these kinds of jobs.
It played so much into my thinking because I think the environment in which I grew up and my childhood, my upbringing was one of extreme struggle and difficulty. So I was born in China. My parents also were born in China, and they had survived the Cultural Revolution, and they were kind of their coming of age was most affected by the Cultural Revolution. They were sent down to the countryside to do manual labor. And the way that they had survived both an extremely tumultuous time in China and immigrating to America, you know, not having their family, barely speaking the language, and then really working multiple, again, manual labor jobs in order to pay their tuitions to finally make it into the middle class. They are people with an intensity that I inherited, and it's especially one toward work and the ability to, I use this phrase in my book, Chukwu, which is eat suffering and eat bitterness. And they just kind of, whatever comes their way, they just eat it. They just work hard, and their entire life up until very recently, when one of my mom is now retired, has been really just all about work. And they instilled in me, the positive side is they instilled in me a work ethic that I take, you know, not only in my Wall Street jobs, but it's also allowed me to be a writer now and work really hard towards that and, you know, publish my book. But the downside of that is it can be taken to the extreme. My mom used to tell me that any second I wasn't studying was a second wasted. You know, in high school, I didn't have or spend any time ever trying to make friends, certainly never any crushes. Because my dad sat me down one day, very early on, freshman year of high school, and told me, "We came to America for you."
Yep, that is amazing. Carrie Sun, thank you so much for illuminating some of the factors that come to bear on us when we're making decisions about what kind of work we do and how long we can sustain it. It's a fascinating ride reading her book, Private Equity. Carrie Sun, our guest today on Life Matters.
ABCRN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.